This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Earlier this week, 121 new members of the 103rd Congress were sworn in. This is the largest infusion of fresh blood to Congress since 1948. There were more women, more minorities, and high expectations. Change was the buzzword of this past election. Voters across the country expressed their frustration with government gridlock and congressional privileges. Bill Clinton assumes the office of the presidency on January 20th and has promised government action on a host of pressing issues in his first 100 days of office. We asked Steve Roberts of U.S. News and World Report to share with us his thoughts about how this new White House and new Congress will work together. He's a senior writer for the magazine and has watched Congresses come and go for some time now. This week, Roberts was anchoring TV coverage of the cabinet confirmation hearings for PBS. I asked him what he learned about this new Congress in the last 2 days.
Yes, I think we learned some very interesting things. One is that we learned that the Republicans are a little intimidated right now by Bill Clinton. There was a lot of bluster right after the election about how we were going to, the Republicans were going to examine the Clinton nominees very closely. They enunciated something they called the Tower Test, which was named for the late Senator John Tower, who was named the Secretary of Defense by George Bush in 89 and was defeated by the Senate. Only the ninth person in the entire history of Congress, by the way, to be defeated, a cabinet nominee to be defeated. And he was defeated because of charges of philandering and excessive drinking, as well as some shady business practices. The real reason John Tower was defeated was because no one liked him. He was a detestable man who made enemies wherever he went. But the Republicans were still smarting from that and saying, well, we're going to do the Democrats what the Democrats did to John Tower. They never came close to doing that.
Why not, though?
I think for two reasons. I think they never found a smoking gun on any of these nominees. Bill Clinton was very shrewd. The target that the Republicans were salivating, that they really wanted to go after, was former Senator Tim Worth of Colorado, who was supposed to be named either Interior or Energy Secretary. He had a long record of some financial improprieties, and he made a lot of enemies among Republicans, and they were dying to go after him. And when he didn't get a job, they lost their main target. But also, I think that they read the mood of the country and saw that the voters did not want all of this, a continuation of all of this naysaying and backbiting. They were tired of it, and the Republicans figured that it would really blow up in their faces if they appeared to be too negative, particularly if they didn't have very good evidence against any of these nominees, which they did not have. The other thing that we learned that was so interesting was the Democrats. There really is a new spirit among the Democrats. Interestingly enough, some of the harshest questioning that, for instance, Robert Reich, the designated Secretary of Labor, got, came from the left, not from the right. It came from old-time liberals who didn't think he was being liberal enough. You heard a lot of rhetoric about partnerships. I mean, if there's one word that was spoken more often than any other word in the hearings in the last 2 days, the word was partnership. Partnership between government and industry, partnership between management and labor. This is not the old Democratic rhetoric of class warfare or us against them or on the side of labor against the evils of corporate capitalism. We're in a new economic world, and in that new economic world, labor and management have to cooperate against the real enemy, which is foreign competition.
The 103rd Congress has more women and minorities represented. Are they the answer to Congress's problems?
Well, they're one answer to Congress's problems, Marty. You know, Bill Clinton during the campaign said that he wanted a cabinet that looked more like America. And the voters made sure that there would be a Congress that looked more like America. There are many more women, many more blacks, many more Hispanics. And what that means is that when the decisions are made, there will be more voices around those tables, voices coming from different experiences and different backgrounds. You take the issue of allocating money for health research. There will be women at that table saying there should be money spent on breast cancer. There should be money spent on research into birth control. In the past, those voices just haven't been there. But it's not just explicitly, it's also implicitly. There are people with, as I say, with different experiences. There's one young congresswoman from Georgia, Cynthia McKinney, 37 years old. She's the single mother of a 7-year-old son. We just haven't had single mothers of seven-year-old sons sitting in the tables of power and bringing that special experience and perspective. So I think it's going to be a very definite plus.
How many of these newcomers would you say are political greenhorns?
Actually, very few. One of the things that's happened over the last generation is that women in particular, blacks and other minorities as well, have really been moving up through the pipeline. And you look around the country today, for instance, 20% of all state legislators in this country are women, but in some states it's as high as 38 or 40%. And if you look at these newcomers, almost all of them have had experience as state legislators or as local mayors or as a woman from San Diego was on the Port Authority in San Diego. That means that while these people did run on the platform of change and did run against Washington, they're very different from that wave of newcomers that came into Congress in 1974 after Watergate, many of whom came out of protest movements and various other motives into public life. These are political pros. They know their way around. And so while they ran against the system, I suspect they're going to fit rather easily into the system.
Well, you've described some of these newcomers, single moms. There are certainly more business people there. There are even some TV anchors. With a more diverse Congress, are we going to see even more gridlock as people who come in with very different points of view try to get their point of view across?
Well, there's always that danger. But I think that that will be outweighed by the feeling of many of the newcomers that they also want to see action. And there are many pressing problems in this country. I was spent the last 2 days, Marty, following the hearings on Capitol Hill of the cabinet nominees. And if you sat in those hearings hour after hour and listened to the members of Congress, members of the Senate, talk to these nominees about the economic problems in their home states. Senator Durenberger of Minnesota talking about workers being laid off from IBM and Northwest Airlines. Senator Pell from Rhode Island talking about 2,000 workers in Rhode Island laid off from the electric boat company. Over and over and over again, the sense of economic disaster hanging over this country and a long-run fear that so many of these jobs that are being lost are not going to come back. They're not going to come back quickly. And if they do come back, they're going to be less well-paying with fewer benefits and less promising future. There is a desperate fear across the country that we are in an economic, headed in toward an economic disaster. And I think that that common theme, which weighs as heavily on Republicans as Democrats, hopefully will have the effect of forcing people to be more accommodating, to try to compromise. That feeling was certainly there over the last 2 days.
So who is the leadership on Capitol Hill? Is it any different than in the 102nd Congress?
Not in terms of individuals, no, it really isn't. There are a few new leaders who will bear watching. There has been some upheaval in the committee structure. For instance, the House Armed Services Committee, which had been headed by Les Aspin, who is now going to be Secretary of Defense, his successor is the first black man ever to be head of this committee. His name is Ron Dellums from California. He is easily one of the most liberal members of the entire House of Representatives. And one of the interesting things that's happened over the last generation or so is that a number of liberals have moved onto the military committees. After Vietnam, they decided that they wanted a voice in how military funds were allocated. And so now not only are you going to have a liberal black as chairman of that committee, you're going to have a very liberal woman. Pat Schroeder of Colorado was the ranking member of that committee. And this is one of those committees that for time out of mind has been run by white men from the South who were among the most conservative members of the House. So this is a revolution. And it's emblematic also of this question of diversity. When you have a ranking, for instance, a ranking member of the Armed Services Committee who's a woman, the whole issue of women in combat, the whole issue of sexual harassment, the whole issue of pay and promotions for women in the armed services is going to receive much, much more attention than if this was still the old white boys network of the past. So there is some new leadership, but of course it takes a long time for these people. Pat Schroeder, who's that woman I mentioned, has been in Congress since 1974. So she's paid her dues for a long time.
The Republican National Committee is meeting later on this month to pick a new chairman or chairwoman, and also to look at its loss in November and to try to make some decisions about the direction that the party should take. Are you seeing any kind of tug of war among Republicans in Congress, tug of war between moderate Republicans and more conservative or right-wing Republicans?
Absolutely. The Republicans are really on the brink of a full-scale civil war. Part of the reason for that is that the great triumph of conservative Republicanism, which really has run this country for most of the last 25 years, was based on two things. It was based on reactions against a set of factors in the 60s, cultural revolution and the anti-war movement and the demand of black power and civil rights. And starting with Richard Nixon in 68, Republicans played very adroitly on that. It was campaigns of law and order and focusing on family values, etc. The memories and the emotions that helped breed that conservative reaction have now faded. When George Bush tried to get the country stirred up over the fact that Bill Clinton had demonstrated against the war 23 years ago, people looked at him and said, "Huh? That's what you care about? That's what you think we care about? It's crazy." So the steam has gone out of the conservative movement in some ways. But the other factor was that Ronald Reagan won the votes of a great many Americans, not because of his ideas, but in spite of them. And he had a warmth and an amiability and about him that attracted an awful lot of people who never would have voted the same way as Ronald Reagan if they had both sat side by side in the American Congress on a lot of bills. Conservatives in the Republican Party deluded themselves into thinking that this was a more conservative country than it was because they misunderstood the power of Reagan, and they misunderstood the historic context in which conservative ideas were popular.
So, and are you saying the Republican Party is having a kind of identity crisis?
Well, an enormous identity crisis, because the conservative purists who believe that somehow George Bush lost because he wasn't pure enough, because he wasn't orthodox enough, I believe are crazy. Talk about inhaling. I think that this is exactly the recipe and exactly the mistake that the Democratic Party made for 20 years. They allowed themselves to be dominated by fringe ideologies and radical thought, which appealed to only a minority slice of the American population. It was the McGovernization of the Democratic Party which helped kill their chances to win the White House for 20 years. And if the Republicans make the same mistake with the Pat Buchananization of the party or the Pat Robertsonization of the party, it's the best present they could possibly hand the Democrats.
Well, I want to talk some more, but I want to take a short break first. And if you're just tuning in, my guest is Steve Roberts. He's a senior writer with U.S. News and World Report. We're talking about the 103rd Congress. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Steve Roberts. He's a senior writer with U.S. News and World Report. Let me shift gears here and talk a little bit about Bill Clinton when he becomes president. Clinton is known for his consensus-building style of government. Do you think that will work with this Congress?
Yes, I think it has a it certainly has a much better chance of working than some of the other models we've seen over the last generation. Jimmy Carter had no appreciation for how Congress worked. He came into Washington with a chip on his shoulder the size of a redwood tree, and he never lost it. He never appreciated Congress. He never worked very well with them. He treated them badly, including members of his own party. He was an equal opportunity in that regard. So I think that model of the last Democrat is one that Bill Clinton is trying desperately to avoid. And I think already he has shown his understanding of Congress and has done very well in wooing them, going up to the Hill, appointing three members of Congress to major, or more than that, but three to very major cabinet posts, Secretary Aspin at Defense and Leon Panetta at Office of Management and Budget, and Lloyd Benson, the Senate Finance Chairman, as Treasury Secretary. These are all going to be very effective and very visible ambassadors. In fact, one Clinton person said to me, if we do this right, you're not going to be able to tell where the executive branch ends and the congressional branch begins. So I think his style of consensus building and reaching out and is very promising.
But is he tough enough in the end, do you think, to make the hard decision?
Well, that's a very important question. Bill Clinton wants everybody to love him. Mm-hmm. And he wants everybody to believe that he's on their side. And when push comes to shove, he is going to have to make people mad at him. And as I said earlier, one of the big tests of his success will be his willingness and ability to make enemies. He is going to have to get people mad. He is going to have to tell people no. The evidence is mixed on that. You know, you look, for instance, at his appointment of an attorney general. Mm-hmm. He gave in to the women's movement by saying, it's got to be a woman. Even though he denounced all the people who were putting pressure on him. In fact, he was playing that game in spades. He agreed that it would be a woman. When some of his early picks declined the honor, he made a very strange choice of a woman who was 40 years old, who less than two years ago, was a staff lawyer at General Electric in Connecticut and did not have a single person reporting to her, was not the boss of a single person, and today she's being handed a department where she's going to have to manage thousands and thousands of lawyers. He did that because he didn't want to tell people no, and he didn't want to tell the women's movement no. That's not a particularly hopeful sign, but on other instances, he's proven to be quite tough-minded and sure-footed in his scaling some very steep political walls. So I know a lot of Democrats who are sort of holding their breath and crossing their fingers and asking the very question you asked, is this guy up to the job? Is he tough enough? Does he have the guts? Does he have the fiber? Does he have the discipline? I think the jury's out on that question.
Well, Clinton has promised a lot of action in the first 100 days, health care and certainly a swipe at the deficit and other programs. Is Congress of the same mind when it really gets down to it? Are they going to be able to do something within the first 100 days?
Yes, I think that you're going to see a number of things happen in the first 100 days, Marty. First of all, you have a significant handful of bills that were held over from the previous Congress, which were vetoed by George Bush or never really got to his desk, which the Democrats now are going to pass in rapid fire style and send to the president. He will sign them with great fanfare. And so in the first week, you're going to see at least the appearance of considerable action. Family leave, probably chief among them. There's a bill to try to make it much easier to register voters, allowing people to do it at the time, for instance, when they apply for driver's licenses. You see motor voter bill. You will see campaign financing. You will see a number of executive orders on issues like the so-called gag rule, which George Bush imposed, which prevented family planning clinics from even mentioning the word abortion. There's a lot left over that can be done quickly and easily. I also think that there is there's a value to politics and there's a value to democracy. And one of the things that people are worried about is they got to face the voters in 2 years. And so that's going to be a big pressure on them to pass an economic program.
Just one more question. As Congresses come and go, as a journalist, do you have to do anything different to cover it?
Well, yes, and that's an interesting question. One of the implications of a lot of what I've been saying is that Congress is a much more open place and a more democratic place today than it used to be. It used to be a generation ago you could cover Congress by just dealing with the leadership, just dealing with the senior barons, because they made the decisions that counted. Now power has been very diffused. And so one thing that's different in terms of covering Congress as a journalist is you've got to know a lot more people, and you've got to, particularly the younger members who come in and who have new ideas and who can force Congress to pay attention to those ideas. Now, that makes leadership much more difficult for the senior members. It used to be that if you had a bill, you could broker a deal by talking to a couple of senior people. Now they got to go one-on-one. It's retail politics, not wholesale politics. It's one of the reasons why Congress, in some ways, is a bit creakier than it used to be, but it's a lot more interesting.
Well, I was going to say, does that make your job a lot more interesting?
It sure does. Sure does. And I think there's another factor, another way that the covering Congress has changed enormously, and that is the way Congress is influenced. You have to understand the forces that work on Congress much more. You have to spend more of your time covering the interest groups. You have to spend more time figuring out how lobbying campaigns are working, not just in the halls of Congress, because many people misunderstand the nature of lobbying. They think it all has to do with people and guys in $1,000 suits walking the halls and strong-arming congressmen. The most effective lobbying these days is done around the country. It's done back in the home district where the local university president or the local PTA president, the local union leader, visits the member of Congress and pleads his or her case directly back home, or organizes a campaign to call all the radio talk shows and back home to promote, concerns about fisheries or wheat sales, whatever it is that concerns the local government. It's much harder as a Washington-based reporter to find out about a lot of these things because they're happening out around the country.
So does that mean you have to venture beyond the Beltway?
Well, I certainly hope so.
Okay. Steve Roberts, thank you very much for joining us on Fresh Air.
Sure, Marty.
Steve Roberts is a senior writer at the U.S. News and World Report. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.